Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Lindsay Whistle-Fenton. During his career as a research associate for Penn State's Ice and Climate Exploration Group, Don Voigt logged 18 seasons in Antarctica, 7 in Greenland, and 2 in Alaska. He was chief scientist in the field for the last several seasons of an important ice core project and helped set up one of the earliest seismic networks across the southernmost continent. Don Voigt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What did you want to be when you grew up? Did you ever think that your career would be something you would spend traveling to the farthest reaches of the Earth?
No, I never thought that. I always had an interest in Antarctica as being interested in geography and geology. I had a very good ninth grade earth science teacher who really got me involved in the subject of geology and geosciences and geography. But I was always doing outdoor things, hiking and canoeing. My dad took us canoeing a lot, and so always outside.
And didn't mind the cold?
No, I didn't. I think of scouting, I had a couple of very cold experiences and somehow kept going back to it. So I've always enjoyed skiing and cross-country skiing.
And your background is in geology, so how did you end up in glaciology? What drew you to that field?
Well, my background is my undergrad was in geology, and when I came to Penn State for grad work, I was in mineralogy and geochemistry, so more on the mineralogy side of that. And we study ice as a mineral, and when I first started with Richard Alley working on ice, that's what he does is... his background is also in sort of understanding ice as a material and how it behaves. And so it was sort of a natural fit for me as a mineralogist to do that sort of work. And it was a convenient time. It happened to work out that he needed somebody with my skill set at that particular time.
And your work with the Penn State Ice and Climate Exploration, or PS Ice Group, meant that you went with a team of scientists to Antarctica to do research on ice sheets there. What were your impressions the first time you landed in Antarctica with your team?
It's very overwhelming. It's you get off the plane and it sort of breathtaking, literally and figuratively. You're in just an amazing spot on the ice sheet near McMurdo Station. And there are mountains all around you, big mountains that come up very quickly out of the ocean. And it's early in the season, so it's sometimes, usually when you get off the plane, it's still very cold. And they open the door and a blast of cold air comes in. So it's an unknown thing. You know, you're with a bunch of people, but it's really a very bizarre sort of surreal situation to walk into, even when you're prepared for it.
Does that feeling go away after maybe the 15th or 16th trip?
Yes and no. It's not quite as unknown, but it's still kind of breathtaking when you step off the plane. You see Mount Erebus, which is about 30 miles away, and smoking. It's an active volcano. And look for the Royal Society Range. And usually the weather is good when you land, so it's usually a beautiful day out. And they don't really give you time to take it all in. They kind of hustle you off. It's a very military-like operation. You know, you don't stand around and gawk. But it doesn't change very much over the years. It's still spectacular when you get off the plane.
And when was your first trip?
The 96-97 season.
Tell us about the journey and getting there. What is it like? How are you traveling? What mode of transportation are you using?
We fly commercial to Christchurch, New Zealand, where the U.S. Antarctic Program bases. And then the next day you get outfitted with your extreme cold weather gear, ECW gear. Another day, you have probably a day in New Zealand, and then you start trying to go south, usually on military aircraft. You report from your hotel 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and it's either a 5-hour flight on C-17 or an 8-hour flight on a C-130. And cargo seats, basically your cargo that talks.
Who went on these trips with you? How many people are we talking on one research team?
It varies quite a bit. My first season, it was myself and two drillers. We were at a camp that had another 10 or 12 people doing another project. Other seasons, it's been myself and three others. When we were doing the seismic work, it would be myself and we'd have two teams of two people. When I did the ice core work, it was a larger group. So it varies season to season.
And you mentioned other teams. So there are other teams from other institutions or other countries there working all at the same time?
Yes, that's correct. Mostly U.S.-supported groups from various universities, usually around 200 scientists in the summertime, working out of McMurdo. There are frequently other countries involved with our projects. A lot of the projects are international.
If they're international, who's ultimately approving the research projects and the teams that go?
Most of all the work I've done is supported by NSF. There's some NASA funding as well. But the whole project, the U.S. Antarctic Program, is an NSF project. So they work in conjunction with other agencies in other countries.
How long are you in the field? How long does one of these trips typically last?
Our field deployments in the deep field go anywhere from a couple of weeks to 2 months in the field. Typically, we'll spend 2 weeks in McMurdo at the beginning getting ready and sometimes a week or two at the end trying to get out. Because everybody's trying to get off the continent at that particular time. So sometimes flights aren't available.
What does your daily routine look like?
That varies quite a bit. In the deep field, once we're set up and running, when we're doing seismic work, we're up pretty early, getting equipment ready and getting breakfast ready and try and get on the trail, try and get out the tents fairly fast. One of the problems is that the sun time is different than the actual time that we keep. So when we're working in the West Antarctic, for instance, we're south of Denver, and we're on New Zealand time. So the warmest part of the day is not at noon. It's like 8 in the morning.
And are we talking 24 hours of daylight?
Yes, that's correct. Wow. Yeah. So, which presents its own problems and people having difficulty sleeping and the urge to continue working even when you know you ought to stop because the sun's still out. And why would you stop working if it's a pretty day and the sun's out and the wind's not blowing? And so it can make for some very long days.
And you mentioned tents. You're staying in tents?
Yes, that's correct.
It's going to be a pretty intense tent.
Yes. Some tents we use are just standard mountain tents that you would buy, you know, downtown. And there are some tents that we get, called Arctic ovens that are made in Alaska. There's a variety of tents. There's the Scott tent, which is a pyramid shape, probably the classic Antarctic pyramid shaped tent that you see with a tunnel entrance. And it's not uncomfortable in there. In the tents, you have a good sleeping bag and insulation from the ground. And by morning, if the sun is up and you're in the West Antarctic, it actually gets above freezing. It actually gets too warm to stay in your sleeping bag sometimes.
What's the coldest temperature you ever endured?
I don't actually know. Is the coldest I recorded and that I knew about was minus 35 C, but I think it had been colder than that, so around minus 40. We spent some time up on the polar plateau, and it's quite a bit colder there than the West Antarctic.
What's something about the climate that surprised you?
The wind is always a problem. There's nothing to stop the wind, so when there's a little system moving through, it's always windy. It is a problem physically to work in the wind. Mentally, it's really, it will drive you nuts when you're in your tent and the wind's blowing hard and doesn't stop and the tent's just sort of ripping. And any flag you put out to mark a trail or to put your tent up starts flapping and it can get to you after a while. But it also makes it difficult when we're doing our seismic work. We can't work when the wind is too high. The moving snow makes noise in our seismometers and basically washes out any signal that we're looking for. So we have to stop working if the wind gets about 10 knots or so, which isn't very high. So there are a lot of times when we just have to work when we can and do the seismic when the wind's not blowing, and then when the wind starts up again, we stop working and wait for the wind to die down again.
Were there times that the climate scared you, or are there any harrowing weather stories you can share with us?
We often, when the wind picks up, the snow starts moving. If it's clear sky out, you can get a ground blizzard where the snow is moving and you can't, might not be able to see your boots, but the sky is perfectly clear and blue and above you, but the snow starts getting higher and higher. But if then you get snow on top of that, or a little bit of ice fog, or it's overcast and you don't really have any definition, you just have what's called a whiteout. You just can't really make out anything on the surface, so you kind of stumble around and try not to trip over any snow drifts or anything. The visibility can get very low, though, and the wind starts picking up. And there were situations when we were doing things, it sort of creeps up on you. You know, it gets gradually worse and worse, and you suddenly realize you're in a whiteout, and if you've flagged your route, you sort of have to stop at each flag and make sure you can see the next one before you start out again. So it can be difficult.
What happens if someone gets sick or hurt out in the field?
Well, we have various levels of medical support. When we're in the field, in the deep field with a small team, there are a couple of us that are trained. I have my wilderness first responder, and so I was kind of the highest level of medical care. We usually have a medical kit with us, and we can contact McMurdo and talk to a doctor and try and work out what's going on. We have to call for a medevac. We have to call for somebody to come get us out. And in the bigger camps, we'll have a medical provider. But again, they have a limited number of things that they can do. In the large camp, we put an emergency medical services team together, though, and actually do drills to make sure everybody knows how to handle situations.
What about mental well-being? I can imagine that, as you said, people are having trouble sleeping because of the 24 hours of sunlight. You're pretty isolated. I would imagine it's pretty important that you like your teammates. Does that ever take a toll?
Yes, it does. We've had a problem occasionally. We've had a situation where we just needed to get somebody out of the field and for reasons that we really, you know, couldn't quantify to McMurdo, he just needed to get out, and we were able to get a plane in that happened to be coming by and get him out of there. It can be difficult. It's stressful. If that happens to you, it's stressful. On the other hand, there are those of us that are just perfectly comfortable in those situations and not worried about it at all and can work, you know, quite happily there, but it's not everybody's cup of tea.
Is there any preparation or evaluation that's done before people leave?
The preparation that we do is our selection. When Sridhar and I talk about who the field team is, we'll think about individuals and how they might respond, but there's really no telling how somebody's going to respond to that situation.
And is there any help available on the continent?
There is, but there is in McMurdo, but it's a matter of getting that person back. And I've never really had the situation where we've had to deal with that. It's sort of the situation where if that person doesn't want to be there, you don't want them to be there. So if somebody suddenly says, I can't deal with this anymore, I need to leave, it's really in your best interest and their best interest to make that happen.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Lindsay Whistle-Fenton, and our guest is Don Voigt, a retired research associate for Penn State's Ice Climate and Exploration Group. He logged 18 seasons in Antarctica. Did you have a family during all of these trips?
Yes, I did. I've had a wonderful family.
How did they deal with these prolonged absences?
Well, I was very lucky because my wife grew up with a Navy family, and so she understood deployments. And the first time I said, I'm, you know, going to do this and it's going to be 6 weeks, that was really no problem for her, because when her dad would go away, it would be for a year you know, 7 months or a year, something like that, on deployments. And he did that on a pretty regular basis when they were growing up. So she understood sort of how that worked. And my kids, I think my daughters were in kindergarten when I started my first season. And of course, they thought it was neat. It was a big game. They used to play a game of what's different in the house when I'd get home, dining room table or things like that.
I think that would be pretty impressive bragging rights for a kid. Kindergartners can say my dad's in Antarctica. How much contact were you able to have with them while you were gone?
Early on, it was very minimal. We had an HF radio, and we would do, if we could get somebody to do a phone patch, we would do that. I did that a couple times. When satellite phones started being developed, it was a lot easier. We could actually call, but even then it was sort of one of those things you didn't do very often. In the later years, I would call more often, and we had sort of rudimentary internet, pretty low bandwidth. There's a couple of decaying satellites that we could hit and get some internet, but that was about it.
The travel and the experiences you're describing sound like such an adventure, but is there ever a time where it does become a little monotonous, kind of like just another day in the office?
It does, but it's always a day in the office that you really love. You get on the snowmobile and you just say, wow, I really love my commute. It's one of those things where when we were drilling, we would walk from our town where Galley was and such and out to the drill site, which is about a half mile away. And you just walk out there. I would ski occasionally and just think, wow, this is, you know, best job in the world. You just love doing it. There are times when it's drudgery, when you're waiting for an aircraft day after day. And there are some stories about, you know, people stuck in camps that want to get home and they're waiting for an aircraft and the weather just is bad, or mechanicals, or we've had planes fly overhead and then bug out because they can't see the ground or whatever reason, and it can get really infuriating. When you have nothing to do, it's the worst.
And in a Penn State News article, I read that you touched on that. You talked about, you know, there's a point every season where you are crammed in a plane or you're waiting for a flight, and everyone kind of asks themselves, why do I put myself through this every year? So why did you put yourself through this time and time and time again?
Oh, I would do it again any minute. It's a very invigorating way of working, and it's just sensational place to be. Just everything around you is beautiful, and it's just an indescribable experience. And the camaraderie is something that's very difficult to reproduce when you're not in a situation like that. You know, especially when you have a great team of people, and we've had some really great teams at Penn State, you know, just some wonderful people. And it's a way of working that's really enjoyable. You don't have the distractions of phones and meetings and all this other stuff. Everything you do is directed towards your work. So it's hard to describe.
What type of work were you doing? What was the predominant theme of the research?
Well, the predominant theme is how the ice behaves, whether it's we're doing ice core or the seismic work. You have these big ice sheets, and we are trying to understand why they do what they do, how they move the way they move, directed towards understanding what happens when the climate changes. So we'll be working on Thwaites Glacier, which is one of the big worrisome glaciers in the West Antarctic, drains into the Amundsen Sea. And it is over-deepened. The bed of the ice is below sea level. And as you go inland, it gets deeper below sea level. So it's pinned on rocks that are on the coast. But as you move inland, the bed gets deeper and deeper, and it's no longer pinned. So the concern is that as the front starts to melt back, we call it a buttress. It's held back by the rock that it's pinned on. When it's no longer pinned on that rock, the ice can start to flow very quickly. My work as a mineralogist, understanding ice as a material, and our work as doing the seismics, understanding what's happening at the bed of the ice, what the ice looks like, and where we can't see it. It's 2 miles thick, or however thick it is. We can only see at the surface. Is all directed towards understanding how the ice behaves and what's going to happen in the future.
kind of a similar question, but Sridhar Nandakrishnan, who you mentioned earlier, who's a professor of geosciences at Penn State, described ICE as being a diary. So what is the most interesting thing you've read in that diary?
Oh, probably from the ICE cores. Every core we come up with is sort of an interesting piece of climate history. And some of the spectacular volcanic eruptions that we see in the ICE core record are really stunning. That Antarctica was such an actively, volcanically active place. And we get ice that has these ash layers in them. Some of the ash layers are from volcanoes that are on the equator, Pinatubo, Indonesia. Quite a few of those volcanoes leave a mark in Antarctica. But quite a few of them are local volcanoes. So that was kind of interesting.
When you drill these cores, how long are we talking? How big are these things?
Well, we drill, the drill is that we just did the Waste Divide core with is capable of pulling up 3 meters or so of ice. We actually cut it when we get it out. The problem is that you can't really handle anything more than about a meter long. So when we get a core up, we measure it very carefully, butt it up against the previous core so we can get an accurate running measure of the depth, and then we cut it, which means we lose a little bit of ice with each cut we make, so we try and do it very carefully. But you can't lift or move a piece of core that's longer than about a meter, so that's what we cut them into.
What happens to it once you cut it? Where does it go?
We bag it and carefully pack it up. It goes by a C-130, what's called a cold deck, a C-130 with all the heat off in the back. Back to McMurdo, goes in a freezer there, and then by ship it goes back to the U.S. and then is kept in Denver at the National Ice Core Lab, where all of the U.S. core is kept.
What kind of changes have you observed to the landscape or maybe to the development or research sites over the span of your career?
Well, the changes to the landscape is difficult, and this is always a tricky question because we work in climate change, and yet when we go inland in Antarctica, we don't really see changes because it's cold. It's well below freezing, and whether it's 22 degrees below or 20 degrees below it, we don't see that difference. We may have some difference in storminess in the inland sites, but that's not something we really have the length of time to observe, and we're not there long enough, and we haven't been going long enough to see changes like that. So mostly what we see is on the edges, on the margins of the continent. We see big changes there in melting and these ice shelves going into the sea. The loss of those ice shelves is really critical to what's happening. The changes in the technology are quite startling.
That was my next question. Back in 1996, what's changed?
Yeah, well, when Sridhar and I started doing the seismic network, our first one was called Anubis, and we had 6 seismometers out across the West Antarctic. That was, the largest deployment of seismometers at that time. We used hard drives, and everything we did was very power intensive. Spinning up a hard drive takes a lot of power, and when it's cold, you have to warm the hard drive up first before it'll even spin up. So we have software that would tell it to not spin up unless the temperature was zero. So there was power involved with just warming the hard drive up and keeping them warm in order to record the data. It wasn't too much longer after that than we started having solid-state drives and solid-state equipment. And that really changed how we do seismic, in particular GPS as well, where you can record things without having to spin up a hard drive. So that was a big change. We went from these recording devices that were just massive to little flashcards to collect data, and you can collect many gigabytes of data on a little flashcard. So everything, the power that it took to do everything we did started to decrease and allowed us to do deployments that would last over the winter in particular because we didn't need to have wind generators providing power for the equipment. So it was one of the biggest changes. Satellite phones was the other one. And Sridhar would tell you that GPS was a big improvement, something that really changed how we do research in sort of in our lifetime.
You retired in September 2017. How are you enjoying your retirement?
It's been an adjustment, but I'm enjoying it. I spent a lot of years not being home for Christmas and not being home for Thanksgiving in particular. I think I probably missed probably 16 out of the 18 seasons I missed Thanksgiving. And so it's been nice to be home and be able to do some projects that I just never had time for. So it's really been enjoyable.
What will you miss most?
Well, I hope... I'm actually hoping I might be able to go again, but I'm not sure that's possible with the based on the current funding climate, whether that'll happen. But I think I'll most miss working with the people that that I was able to work with, and just going to that climate, going to Antarctica is a special place, and it's hard to describe if you've never been. The closest I can describe it would be being at sea, and not a lot of people get that opportunity either. So, but there's something special about it that just gets into your system, and I think that I'll miss that in particular.
What advice would you give to someone who is interested in pursuing a career like the one you've had?
Oh, there are lots of opportunities. I would say don't give up on pursuing an opportunity to go. There are opportunities out there, and if it's something you really want to do, you just sort of need to find the way to do it. It may be a little more difficult now than it was 20 years ago when I started, but I think it's still possible. There's still quite a few people going down and quite a few research groups. You have to be flexible, though. You have to be willing to do what needs to be done. My son came down with us 1 year, and he was not a scientist. He's not a scientist. He's a writer, and he does mission work in Ireland now, but he went down as a field hand, and Sridhar had him on his field team at one point and loved him because he would ask Ted to dig a hole and Ted wouldn't discuss why you wanted that hole dug or how big it should be or anything. Just said, okay, what do you need, and I'll do it. And so you have to sometimes suspend your questions about everything and just do what needs to be done. Someone once asked me what skills they would be most valuable for somebody going down. And I told them, well, do you know how to cook? Learn how to cook, because that'll really get you far. And can you fix an engine? If you can fix a two-stroke snowmobile engine, you'll be hired on the spot. Those kinds of things are really valuable in a field team. They're little intangibles that it's not always somebody that's really smart with math or, So, yeah.
Well, that's great advice. Don Voigt, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Don Voigt is a former research associate for Penn State's Ice and Climate Exploration Group. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Lindsay Whistle-Fenton, WPSU.